Thank you for standing by. This is the conference operator. Welcome to the Fingon conference call. As a reminder, all participants are in listen-only mode, and the conference is being recorded. This call is copyrighted material and owned by Fingon Holdings. Written permission must be given for any reproduction of this transcript. After the presentation, there will be an opportunity to ask questions. To join the question queue, you may press star, then one on your telephone keypad. Should you need assistance during the conference call, you may signal an operator by pressing star and zero. I would now like to turn the conference over to Vanessa Winter, Investor Relations. Please go ahead.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining us this afternoon for a review of our recently announced financing and our first quarter 2016 update. Joining me on today's call is Phil Hartstein, Fingon's President and CEO, and Michael Noonan, CFO. As a reminder, this call is being webcast, and a replay of the webcast will be available on our website. Before I begin, I would like to quickly make note of our safe harbor. During the course of this call, we may make statements related to our overall business outlook, future financial operating results, timing of redemption of shares of Series A preferred stock, accounting matters, and future prospects. These are forward-looking statements based on certain assumptions and are subject to a number of risks and uncertainties that could cause future results to differ materially from our expectations. You can learn more about these risks in our most recent Form 10-K filed with the SEC on March 25th, 2016, as well as our subsequent filings. These documents are available on the Investor Relations page of our website at www.fingon.com. We assume no obligation to update any forward-looking statements. I'd also like to mention that Fingon management will be attending a number of upcoming conferences, so we hope we get the opportunity to touch base with many of you in person. We will be at the 17th Annual B. Riley Conference from May 24th through 26th in Los Angeles, California, the Markins Micro Cap Conference taking place June 1st and 2nd in New York, and finally, LD Micro's Invitational Conference from June 7th to 9th in Los Angeles. Please contact me, Vanessa@Fingon.com, to schedule a meeting. Finally, Fingon will host its annual meeting of stockholders on June 22nd at 9 a.m. Pacific Time at our headquarters in East Palo Alto. With that, I would like to turn the call over to Phil Hartstein, Fingon's President and CEO. Phil?
Thank you, Vanessa, and thank you all for joining today's call. There are a number of catalysts impacting our business in the coming quarters, and we saw this as an opportunity to update our stockholders. I would like to start with our progress and successes to the recent challenges against Fingon's patents at the USPTO and PTAB, provide you an update on our litigation efforts, including recent past and upcoming trials, and finally offer my perspective on our Series A preferred financing, which we announced last week, before turning the call over to Michael, who will address the financial and operational sides of our business. As Fingon approaches its 20-year anniversary this coming November, I'd like to review our involvement in the cybersecurity sector, the state of the art for current technology, and address the headwinds present in the licensing side of our business. These include legislative initiatives, precedential, judicial, and court rulings, and, of course, procedural changes at the U.S. Patent Office. These challenges are threatening a number of business models, and we've recently seen several companies significantly pivot just to survive. That said, Fingon has been successfully licensing our foundational technology and patents for more than 19 years. With the past 3 years, we journeyed into the public company realm, the last 2 years listed on NASDAQ. We continue to believe we are poised for growth with an ever-strengthening portfolio of patents, investments in the cybersecurity sector, and within our emerging business units. Let's start with the U.S. Patent Office and the recently created Patent Trials and Appeals Board, or PTAB. Through the USPTO and PTAB, there are several administrative processes to challenge the validity of a patent. Specifically, with the newly created PTAB, nearly 80% of challenged patents fail to survive review, having the claim significantly limited, if not completely canceled. This leads to a highly unpredictable outcome, with retroactive effect, often forcing companies to walk away from their investments in innovation. As you've most likely seen through our recent press releases, we are in the process of working through many of these same challenges, including re-exams at the USPTO and inter-parties reviews, or IPRs, at the PTAB. The IPR process is relatively new, and you might expect there are some fundamental things to work through. Finjan, however, has had early success in fending off these challenges, with approximately 70% of challenges against its patents being denied institution or review, versus the industry average of only 20% achieving this early dispositive outcome. We believe this is an indication of the durability of Finjan's patents. Looking at the numbers specifically, we are currently facing 40 IPRs, with 17 out of 24 decisions being denied institution. This means the PTAB, after reviewing the merits of each challenger's petition, concluded no review was necessary. Of these 40 IPRs, 14 or 35% are joiners. What that means is that a third party has effectively copied another challenger's petition and asked the PTAB to allow them to tag along. This is like a Me Too IPR. It's duplicative, generally includes nothing new, and under the motion for joinder, it's also subject to the same outcome as the original challenger's petition. To date, only one joinder has been instituted. Of the seven IPRs that have been instituted, they only challenge four of Finjan's patents. Of course, now these enter the traditional roughly year-long process where we go before the PTAB in a mini-trial of sorts limited to the validity of the patents. Finjan has asserted 22 of its issued patents across its litigations, and there are still 16 IPRs pending. Again, many of those are double-counted due to joinder filings. Moving on to the reexamination numbers, there have been 9 reexams filed, with 5 out of 6, or 83%, being confirmed, meaning no changes to the claims as they were originally issued. 1 has been canceled, and 3 are pending. As litigants exhaust their ability to challenge our patents, we continue to believe there will be an inflection point where licensing discussions and litigation settlement talks are less focused on an invalidity argument. It seems all too easy in the current licensing climate to erroneously state, quote, your patents are invalid, end quote, and much less credible given the progress we are making at the USPTO and PTAB. While we always prefer a licensing pathway, sometimes the need to enforce our inventions becomes necessary. Most of you are aware of our nearly $40 million verdict won against Blue Coat. After a 2-week trial, we received a verdict and award from the jury in August of 2015, a judgment from the court in November of 2015, and we are still working through the post-trial motions process. One of the last stages is what's called a JMAL hearing, which occurred last week, and we are waiting for the final district court order on that verdict amount, whether the court will grant pre- and post-judgment interest, and an answer on our request to recover fees and expenses in this case. We are feeling optimistic about the future of this decision, but we expect Blue Coat will elect to challenge the case at the Federal Circuit. By our initial analysis, we would expect the appeals process to extend into the middle of 2017. We have also filed a second separate case against Blue Coat in front of the same judge in the Northern District of California. Consistent with our licensing best practices, we do remain committed and hopeful that we can achieve a resolution with Blue Coat through licensing and settlement, including both the first and second cases. We have 2 additional trials scheduled to take place over the next couple of months. The first is Proofpoint, with a scheduled trial start date of June 13, and soon thereafter, Sophos, with a scheduled trial start date of September 6th. First, let's talk about the Proofpoint trial. We will proceed with 5 asserted patents in the case. Also of note, there is a second named defendant, Armorize. Armorize was a separate technology company acquired by Proofpoint in 2013, right around the time we filed our lawsuit. Our infringement claims extend into both Proofpoint and Armorize, as both technology platforms have been integrated over the last 2 years. The trial is expected to last 7 days and be completed by June 22nd. Next, a brief update on our litigation with Sophos. This case was originally filed with 8 FinJohn patents. We are at the point in the pretrial planning where I would expect that number to be reduced either by the order of the court or through our own election to streamline the issues for the jury. The trial is presently scheduled to last about 2 weeks, ending on September 16th. Before I turn the call over to Michael to go into the financial and operational details, I want to review our financing announced last week. We are thrilled that we have secured $10.2 million in Series A preferred financing with Halcyon and Soren. This was achieved through our banking relationship with B. Riley, who sought out funding partners for us, and we believe this to be a deal of distinction in our industry. Principally, these Series A shares are in a preferred class and will not dilute shareholders holding common stock shares. The structure affords FinJohn the option to retire the preferred securities when funds are available, cannot be converted into common stock, and does not include any warrant coverage nor evergreen revenue share after the securities are retired. Halcyon is a private diversified equity fund, and Soren IP Group serves as a patent advisory and finance firm that creates, manages, monetizes, and finances the patent operations of clients. On a professional note, when you're out in the market and considering raising money, you really have to appreciate that you're interviewing financiers to become your partners, not just your investors. We believe that Halcyon and Soren not only appreciate the complexities of our business, but we're able to see through the risks and recognize all that FinJohn has achieved through its licensing and enforcement initiatives. This equity partnership represents FinJohn's first capital raise since becoming a public company 3 years ago and offers renewed confidence in FinJohn, our historical licensing and enforcement results, and our long-term staying power. I would now like to turn the call over to Michael to run through our first quarter results and our recently announced financing in more detail. Michael.
Well, thanks, Phil. I'd like to start by offering an update on our first quarter results. Please note that unless otherwise stated, all comparisons are on a year-over-year basis. We had $2.3 million in revenue attributable to two licensing agreements in our quarter ended March 31, 2016. $2 million from a September 2014 license and $300,000 from an April 2015 licensing agreement. This compares to no revenue in the same period last year. Operating expenses, which primarily consist of SG&A, decreased by 19% or $800,000 compared to 1 year ago to $3.4 million. This was driven by a nearly $1 million decrease in litigation expenses, as well as a $400,000 decrease in compensation expenses. These improvements were partially offset by a $300,000 increase for CyberRisk, our advisory services business, which started in July of 2015, and an operation-related expense increase of $200,000, partially related to our emerging FinJohn Mobile business, which was also launched in July of last year. Despite our two emerging businesses, FinJohn Mobile and CyberRisk, prudent expense controls and revenue in the quarter led to a 70% reduction in our loss from operations over the same period a year ago. We ended the quarter with $5 million in cash and cash equivalents, and $2.7 million of working capital. The $1.1 million decrease in our cash from December was driven by a $3.4 million in operating expenses and was offset by the $2.3 million in licensing revenue discussed earlier. You know, given Phil offered an update on our current licensing and enforcement efforts, I'd like to give an update on our emerging businesses. Turning to CyberRisk, while the business has taken some time to ramp, we now have customers under contract, and our pipeline looks solid. As cybersecurity becomes a top priority for enterprise companies, CyberRisk's theme of the data room to the boardroom is resonating. I was recently in London, England, attending the Data Risk Management and Financial Services Conference. Yoram Galansky, CyberRisk CEO, was on a panel speaking on management, risk, integrity, and security, which focused on identifying key operational vulnerabilities for corporations. During the conference, we discussed many aspects of the business, and the team remains confident that we were moving in the right direction, particularly as we see demand for the types of services we are offering. To that end, we can say that deals have been signed, and we expect somewhere in the range of $150,000 to $300,000 of new client business in the second quarter. While things have taken a little longer than initially planned, we remain committed to this business. In FinJohn Mobile, we have launched an enhanced site that features our new and improved mobile secure browser, which is built off of FinJohn's patented technology. As we look towards the future, unifying devices through MDM, or mobile device management, interfaces seem to be the next trend in the mobile security arena. This theme was echoed at the RSA conference in San Francisco and the Data Risk Management conference I mentioned earlier. This includes protecting mobile devices as we enter the workplace and securing data so it doesn't leave the network. We do not see our mobile platform as a significant revenue-generating business in the near term. However, we are excited to be back in the world of development and will continue to look for ways to grow this business. Finally, our investment in the cybersecurity of tomorrow through Jerusalem Venture Partners, or JVP, has proven to be fruitful. We've invested $1.7 million of the committed $5 million investment and received a gross entitlement of $1.3 million, of which $800,000 was paid to us in cash, and $500,000 was reinvested in the fund. I'd now like to review our recently announced financing. As Phil mentioned, this is a meaningful deal through which we were able to secure $10.2 million in financing with no dilution to our current common stockholders. The Series A preferred stock is not convertible into common stock, and there are no warrants associated with this financing. These shares can be liquidated at 1.5 times the original purchase price within 90 days, 1.65 times the purchase price before year one, and 1.75 times the purchase price between 1 and 2 years of closing. There are some revenue sharing provisions which are capped at the liquidation preferences. A litigation event could trigger up to 50% to investors within 1 year of closing and up to 70% to investors within 2 years of closing. On the licensing front, the Series A stockholder is paid 20% within 1 year of closing and 40% within 2 years of closing. The financing is scheduled to be funded on or before May 20th, 2016. Now, this financing not only helps to support our licensing and enforcement activities, but general day-to-day operations, but also represents something much larger. B. Riley, along with Halcyon and Soren, have seen our portfolio strengthened through our $40 million win against Blue Coat and our successful navigation of both PTAB and USPTO challenges against our patents. We appreciate their confidence in FinJohn, and we look ahead to a promising future. Now, we believe that the efforts of our litigation and license strategies, along with our new businesses and investments, will significantly improve shareholder value. Now, with that, I'd like to turn the call back over to Vanessa to coordinate the Q&A. Vanessa?
Thanks, Michael. Operator, can we please pull our first question?
Thank you. We will now begin the question and answer session. To join the question queue, you may press star, then one on your telephone keypad. If you are using a speakerphone, please pick up your handset before pressing any keys. To withdraw your question, please press star, then two. Our first question is from Mike Crawford of B. Riley & Company. Please go ahead.
Thanks. Your SG&A expense last year was $17 million, $3.4 million in Q1. About how much of that is legal, and ancillary to that, what would you expect to be a good range of legal expense before any contingency payouts in 2016, given the known two trials and some anticipated IP challenge activity? Thank you.
Yeah, Mike, this is Michael Noonan here. So rough numbers is about 50% of our FG&A of 2015. If we look at litigation costs in 2016. It's probably about the same. I'm going to say $7.5 to $8 million. That will, of course, depend, go to trial with both defendants this year. If we're able to garner a settlement, of course, numbers will go down in terms of expenses.
Okay, thank you. And then regarding cyber risk, you now have some initial customers under contract. At what point would you anticipate that business to start to be accretive to operations?
So, you know, as you know, there's revenue recognition issues as it applies to consulting business, consulting revenues. So we're working through those with our accountants as well at Markham. And I think it's going to take the full year or full balance of the year for that to really get rolling. One of the challenges you have with consulting services business is as you get more customers, you have to have more people doing the work. However, economies of scale will greatly assist us. So I think in the beginning, not as accretive. I think towards the end of this year, we'll really start to get a better handle on that, and I think we'll see that those revenue numbers being accretive to the bottom line.
Okay, thank you. And then last question for me relates to any potential changes in IP law that you are tracking given cases that the Supreme Court is looking at. Thank you.
Mike, this is Phil Hartstein. I'll take that one. Certainly, we indicated that there's a number of headwind challenges that present themselves in the IP licensing side of our business. There's political sort of reform initiatives. There's sort of, as you referred to, things that are going on in the federal courts as well as at the Supreme Court. And then also we find that there's a tremendous amount of opportunities to use the administrative proceedings at the Patent Office. So I guess I'll address sort of all three of those. On the political side, we're getting an understanding that given that this is an election year, that intellectual property has not necessarily already represented itself as a key election year issue. So you may see some tweaking around the edges, but I don't expect anything significant there. In the federal courts, you're starting to see a reversal or at least clarification. For example, some may be familiar with the Supreme Court's Alice decision and how that's getting applied. So we now have, as of Friday, two cases that clarify that software patents, which we don't believe really relate to us, but you're starting to see a shift that software patents are not just now outright vague and abstract. Those two cases are DDR and EnFish. The Supreme Court, as you indicated, is also hearing a number of cases. I'd prefer to not comment necessarily on that, except to say that we all in the industry are eagerly awaiting the Supreme Court's decisions, which, if I had to look a little bit forward, I would generalize and say we expect those to be positive for patent owners. And finally, I would say at the USPTO on the re-exam side and at the PTAB for the IPR side, we do see there becoming a better framework for actually applying continuity in the review and exam process. We have been fortunate to have great examiners who have reviewed our cases, and we believe they're reaching the right conclusions in determining that that Finjan's patents, when issued, were novel. And today, as we're seeing through our cases, continue to be state-of-the-art.
Great. Thank you very much.
The next question is from Lisa Thompson of Zacks Investor Research. Please go ahead.
Hi, everyone. I guess my first question is cyber risk. The revenues that you mentioned, is that for like one-time projects or is that an ongoing contract for a year or so? Like what kind of contracts are they?
Hi, Lisa. This is Mike and I are looking at each other. I'll take this one because we've recently been going through this. What we tend to find in the cyber risk proposals and now with the recent contract deals that they have is that there is a sort of an expected value of the contract. So, for example, if the contract is $1, you know, that's expected bookings. As we've learned to understand more about servicing these types of engagements, We also see that in many cases, the opportunity to generate revenues under that existing, for example, $1 contract, they sometimes extend 20 to 25% beyond, which moves into the implementation phases. So we don't count that as contract revenue, but we do expect to see that there will be a greater than $1 performance, for example, per contract.
So it's not something where you sign a contract that says, we will do a one-year review of your company, and then you book it ratably. It's kind of like, go in and do something for me and send me a bill for one-time effort?
Yeah, Lisa, this is Mike. So a lot of these are initially project-based contracts. What we hope to achieve is that we'll see a revenue stream coming out of them after we do the initial project. So, for example, penetration testing, red teaming, things along those lines where we put together a list of proposals and suggestions for what the customer should be doing. And then there may be an implementation phase and an ongoing servicing phase after that. So the initial ones, though, right now are project-based one-off agreements.
Okay, great. All right, and so back to this financing. This thing is something I've never seen before, so you're going to have to help me here. How is this going to show up on the income statement? You're going to have a preferred stock or change in value of loan payable, or how is this going to work?
So, Lisa, it's Mike here again. Even though this is a preferred share, because the preferred shares are redeemable, we think our auditors will treat it more like debt. We're working through that with our auditors right now. You're right, it is a unique deal and something that we'll have to look at very carefully. But I think it'll go something along these lines. We'll have to determine the expected life. We'll probably see a quarterly accrued interest number, which is the delta, if you like, between the principal and wherever the payout is, based on a quarterly number. So that's where I think we'll end up, and it'll be in other expenses on the income statement.
Okay, so that's what I thought. So let me kind of understand the math here. So they gave you $10.2 million, and then if somebody knocks on your door within the next, 90 days, 60 days, and gave you $30 million to license something, you could tomorrow send them a check for you'd have to send them a check for $15.3 million?
That'd be correct.
20%?
That'd be
1%?
Okay. No, it would be just the 1.5 times the original principal. Let's just make the math a little easy and just say it was $10 million. If someone
right.
walks in the door and gives us 30, we would pay them $15 million, right? 1.5 times the 10. Just to make the math easy.
Right, okay. And so what's that 20%, 40% thing? Do they get a piece of that too?
No.
Do they get 20% over the 10.2?
So think about it this way. Let's say no one walks in our door and gives us $30 million, but tomorrow we get a license for, call it $1 million, just to make the math, again, easy. We would pay the investors, if it was licensing revenue, 20% of that. So they would get $200,000.
Okay.
To pay down, and we would be redeeming some of those preferred shares. So it's an if-or. I mean, we believe that these preferred shares will be around for, let's call it a couple of years. We'll be getting licensing and litigation revenue throughout that two-year time frame. That note, then you'll see that in our income statement going down as we're redeeming some of those preferred shares. And then, of course, this gets us to the Blue Coat number. So think about the calendar like this. We expect Blue
right.
Coat to exhaust all of its court dealings, let's call it second or third quarter of 2017. The two-year anniversary of these notes will expire in the second quarter of 18. So we've got good runway there to solve that issue with Blue Coat.
And then if it happens there, once you've maxed out, you end up giving them $28 million.
No, the maximum, well, it all depends on the timing. So if we pay the amount, if we pay the amount off before 2 years, it'd be $17.5 million. And it may be less than that, depending on when some of these revenue streams come in. The only time it gets up to $28 million is if we go past 2 years.
Right. So that's the maximum. I tried to, like, draw it all out, but now you threw this 20. So I get the 20%. It's like you sell a cake and you owe me a dollar for every cake you sell. So I get that.
There you go. That's it. That's it.
I saw this on Shark Tank. I know how to do this.
Very good.
So, okay. So now the other question is, if you're giving them 20% of everything you take in, does that go up in cost of goods? Or does that go off net revenues now?
No, it'll go
on that bottom note. Okay.
Yeah, the only thing in cost of goods will typically be any contingency relationships that we have. This will be an expense line, you know, below, it'll be down in SG&A and other expenses somewhere.
And will it get its own line item? Like?
Yeah, I would imagine.
Okay, so it's not up in cost of goods, that you don't net it with revenue.
Correct.
All right. Oh, good grief. Okay. All right, I think I kind of get it, but I'm sure we're going to have to talk about this when I
start playing
with the income statement. Great. Thank you.
You bet, Lisa.
Nice to hear about cyber risk. I'm glad it's making some good progress. I'll see you
at Markham. Absolutely.
All righty. Bye-bye. Thanks.
Cheers.
The next question is from Josh Silverman of Iroquois. Please go ahead.
First, Phil, congratulations on the financing. Hopefully that will remove some financing overhang that the stocks, I think, have been feeling recently. But I have a quick question on Cisco. I see, and I know I've been an investor for a while. They're a shareholder. I just saw that they lost two similar patents in the Delaware courts, and I'm just wondering, are they a licensee, or is there anything you can tell us about that?
It's a good question. We actually follow a number of these litigations that are in a similar security space. So for those on the call, what Josh is referring to is a case outcome that came down last week on two security patents that were held by SRI, in which Cisco was deemed to infringe. So there's two questions in there, Josh. The first is Cisco being a shareholder. I can confirm that Cisco is a reporting shareholder. I think they reported about 7.5% of our outstanding common equity. And the answer to your second question is that, no, they are not a licensee.
Okay. Thanks, Phil. That was all.
As a reminder, if you have a question, please press star, then one. The next question is from David Hoff, a private investor. Please go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. Hey, I'm good. Just congratulations on the financing. There looked like there's also good news at the patent office on the 968 patent IPR from, I think it was Palo Alto.
You are ahead of most folks on this call. Yes, there are emails coming in, yes.
Just a quick question on that front. Is there an ability to go after some of these, I'll call them serial IPR filers, where most of these have been kicked out, and I'm sure you guys have spent considerable amount of resources fighting these things? Is that something you guys can possibly recover with outside of the litigation?
You know, it's a good question. Let me, just for the benefit of others on the call, illuminate a little bit about what David is referring to. In the IPR process, you can challenge the validity of someone's patent, and the basis for the IPR being instituted is whether or not there's a substantial new question of patentability. So one of the things that we are finding in our portfolio is that we see a lot of repetitive art, meaning prior art that has been known about by the patent office for quite some time. We see it showing up recurringly in the vast majority of our IPRs, in other words, very little new prior art, and yet still we are burdened with the expense of having to fight these, one, and two, the delay, if you will, in trying to advance licensing and settlement discussions. As part of the original process, the USPTO and the PTAB had conceptually thought that there would be more judicial efficiency by removing the technical question about a patent's validity from the court, moving it into the patent office to be determined. And in exchange for that sort of offloading of the technical side, you would not be able to bring what they call estoppel, those same arguments then into the courtroom. Unfortunately, David, I actually don't think that the estoppel is applied as it should be, meaning that you're going to see these challenges continue to present themselves, even though an IPR may have been denied at the patent office. We still expect to see continued IPR filings. We still expect to see similar arguments made in our trials. It's just the state of affairs until it gets worked out.
Okay. I guess I roll into my second question. Is there, you know, a licensing opportunity with non-defendants? Maybe you can give us the number of standstill agreements that might be out there and in place. I'm trying to look at a licensing model that doesn't include all of the current litigation.
That's a really great question. So I'll try and talk to you at a high level. We generally don't describe our licensing pipeline. It is very active. You also alluded to something that may not be known by most, is that one of the tools that you can use to engage in a constructive licensing discussion outside of litigation is that you offer a potential licensee a non-disclosure agreement and a standstill, which just says, look, we are not here purely about litigation. We are here to have a conversation. We would like that conversation to start on the technical side and have a legal and technical discussion. And then from there, we move into both value and pricing discussions. So we have a number of those conversations ongoing at any given time. If you were looking to try and size and scope how many of those there are, I can share with you how I've described this publicly before, is that our job here is to license the industry, which means wherever we find companies that are using FinJohn's patented inventions, that we seek to license them under fair value terms. And to best do that, I think you could look at traditional market research. You could look in the endpoint software spaces, in the web infrastructure spaces, and in some subset of the traditional networking segment, really focused on perimeter defense technologies. And maybe a fourth market vertical would be moving into mobile security, which is part of the reason why we have FinJohn Mobile and why we are moving that direction on a development front ourselves. So I think if you looked at the market research, you'd be able to see how many companies are out playing in this space.
Okay, and there's an expectation that the company's actively speaking with them. You know, there might be a dozen opportunities out there.
I would say you're shy on a dozen, and yes, we are actively discussing licensing deals with a number of parties, yes.
Okay. I guess rolling into the next question is, would there be an expectation that mediation sessions will now have, you know, a different tone to them, where, you know, I would imagine they've been using your balance sheet as, you know, as a weakness for you guys. Now it's kind of been refortified. A lot of these IPRs have now gone away. You have very good Markman opinions, a trial that was already won. You know, at some point, some of these guys, you know, have to look at actually doing a licensing discussion. Is that you think that is feasible at this juncture, or most of these will need to go to trial?
Well, we have, and some of you may know, we have licensing best practices, and so internally, we stay focused on trying to identify opportunities to resolve disputes. I think in most cases, I give you a couple of examples. I think in most cases, there's a significant disconnect between value. And in most of these, we're not seeking full value. That's what trial is for. Trial gets you to full value. We're often trying to find what we call fair value, and that's at some discount, understanding that there are risks to both sides. We are willing to negotiate and be flexible on how we would get paid for a license. We've taken on a number of opportunities where we've taken equity. We've taken, as part of the cash compensation, we've taken intellectual property and obviously cash. We've even structured cash payments over time. So we are not here to impede the business and the growth of the cybersecurity market, but we are working to find fair value in licensing. The second part of your question is, do we think we're going to see a change? And my answer there is unfortunately, I wish that were the case. What we tend to find is that there's always some other minute detail or some other event before trial or something that gets very easy for companies who are well down the road of litigation on their way to trial to not fully engage in that process, which is unfortunate. However, we do regularly meet for court-appointed and out-of-court mediations and settlement discussions with parties, and some are more engaged than others. That's about all I can tell you on that, despite, you know, putting you in the room, so I might stop there.
Okay. I guess my last question turns to the operating side. Is there opportunities outside of the company that you might be able to bring in as an acquisition that might be, you know, $1 or $2 million deals, private companies that, you know, need a capital infusion and, you know, would benefit from, I guess, an experienced cybersecurity management team along with the patents? Is that something that the company is actively looking at, and maybe the number of potential deal sizes or your pipeline that might be out there?
Yeah, David, this is Mike Noonan. I think the short answer to your question is yes. It will all depend on price and time. Currently, right now, you know, we are focused on these two court hearings coming up. We've got a lot of things that are in the pipeline right now from an organic perspective. But let's say, for example, we could find something in the mobile industry that would complement the area that we've already started. Ideally, maybe the company has some patents already that could enhance our portfolio, and they would have an operating team. Wouldn't necessarily have to be revenue generating, or even, you know, certainly not break even. But quite frankly, some of the companies we saw earlier in this period were, they got the costs were very lofty. So we're being patient right now. We're going to manage the M&A pipeline, if you like, or the M&A activities very carefully. But again, I think anything that's in the mobile security area would be something that we would really be interested in. Again, depends. And of course, pricing issues and the like. As we sit right now, with our stock price where it's at, even though it's, we've seen some improvement in the past little while, as we've made some announcements, I think we're still a little light there.
Okay, that's it for me. Thank you.
Thanks, David. Appreciate your question.
This concludes the question and answer session. I would like to turn the conference back over to Vanessa Winter for closing remarks.
Thank you all for joining us this afternoon. We look forward to seeing you at upcoming events, and we'll speak to you then.
This concludes today's conference call. You may disconnect your line. Thank you for participating and have a pleasant day.